Thanks for joining us for the first installment of our podcast series for Women's History Month. I'm Judith Warner. I'm a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, and I'm here with Ella Edmondson Bell, who is a professor of business administration at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth and author of the widely acclaimed book, Our Separate Ways, Black and White Women and the Struggle for Professional Identity. And she's also the founder and president of Ascent, a national not-for-profit organization committed to the professional development and career advancement of multicultural women. Professor Bell, thank you so much for being with us.
I am delighted to be here, Drew. This is great.
Well, you were the star of our first kickoff women's leadership event, and I'm so grateful that you've been willing also to stick around and talk afterwards.
Sure.
We started off the series of events that we're doing, talking about the leadership issues of women of color, really wanting to broaden the conversation about women's leadership in America, which has been hot for about a year now, I'd say, mm-hmm. but has also been very narrow and very partial. And what's been missing?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for taking the charge and actually putting this topic on the table. It is critically important that we bring all women ahead rather than just a certain segment of the female population. So I give you all the credit and thank yous in the whole wide world to do that. I think what's very interesting in the conversation now, we need to give Sheryl Landsberg some credit. Whether you agree with Lean In or whether you don't agree with Lean In, younger women connected to that book. Younger women saw themselves in reading that book. And younger women realized that they weren't where they needed to be or where they wanted to be. And they began to make a calling. And we could see this. We could see it. We saw it at Tuck with our female students. We saw it nationwide. You see it at conferences like the Makers Conference. Young women recognize that they've got to be involved in making the change to bring women ahead. And that's critically important. If for no other reason, they were using the F word about feminization. They honored Gloria Steinem. So we are beginning to see a rebirth, if you will. The problem is that my fear is that it's a rebirth of only a certain group. Elite women, white women, educated. If you happen to be part of that circle as a woman of color, and there are women of color in those circles, you have some voice. But I'm not sure that we are being collaborative or being allies with each other to really address some of the broader issues around women in our society, in our country.
So how do we go about addressing that? How do you bring that kind of change when, in fact, it's only a certain segment of the female population who really get their voices elevated, let's say, in the media, get the big book contracts with the PR machine to put it out afterwards? How do you do it? How do you bring all these other voices to the table in a really meaningful way?
I think we need to have a place to have the voices in the room, number one. We seem to get research that if you're from a well-known institution, it gets played. If you're not in a well-known institution, it doesn't get played. So a study a couple of years ago about the wealth gap for women and the gap between, and wealth is not the money you bring home. It's how, based on what you own. It's not income. It's what you own, what gets passed down to you in terms of money, finances, bonds, stock, that kind of thing. And for Hispanic and black women, it was like the wealth was like $4. It was ridiculous. For white women, it was 4,000 something. I don't remember the numbers, but it was such a glaring, discriminatory kind of reality. What amazed me was that nobody talked about this report for a long time. It was like a blip. I got to the NBC, ABC, CBS News. Very, very, very little. There wasn't a big spread in the New York Times. You know, there might have been some mention of it. But those studies that give us insights with what's really happening in our country, don't get paid a lot of attention. We don't use those as points to create dialogue, to talk, to really address we've got an issue here. We keep talking about pay equity. Pay equity impacts basically those more in a corporate reality. They're not addressing pay equity in school systems where women, you know, don't get paid the amount, or women who are in health, or women who are in social services, or women who work for the government. You know, we really have to have a dialogue when we bring those voices in, and a place that will create that, whether it's a think tank, whether it's a series of meetings. And I don't mean show and tell meetings. We are so past the age where I need to sit in a room and hear about, you know, well, this is what's happening to the women. We need to roll up our sleeves and say, okay, this is what we need to do to make a difference.
And you're making a really important point about leadership. You know, leadership is a word that can be alienating to people who don't identify with it, either because they don't see women like themselves represented in those roles, or because they just don't see themselves within the traditional, you know, definition of leadership. But when we talk about leadership, let's say here at CAP in this context, we're really talking about economic empowerment, right? We're talking about political empowerment, possibly, or economic empowerment in terms of what it means to have a voice that is heard. It comes down to having this very basic level of empowerment in the first place. But these words often that then lead us to the pay gap, that lead us to talking about income inequality, let's say, when we're talking about empowerment, and also lead us to talking about prejudice, racism. These are not such feel-good words the way leadership is.
They're not sexy.
No, they're not sexy.
But we have to understand that in our country, those are the divisive elements in our society, historically. And if you don't talk about them, if you don't bring them to the forefront, then you're not going to really address the real issues. It will continue to create this division between those who have and those who do not have. And if we're talking about real leadership in our country, we want everybody to be able to have a chance and to be able to make a difference, to build our country, to build our society. We can't succeed as a country if only half the population has an opportunity for advancement, has an opportunity for education, has an opportunity to be able to have a good quality of life, has an opportunity for health insurance. We can't do that.
And all of that is bound up in leadership.
Because, all that's bound up in leadership. And the other thing is the people that we're talking about, the have-nots, those are the worker bees.
Right.
Those are the people that are, you know, in your call centers. Those are the people that are, you know, taking care of our elders. Those are the people that are educating our children. I mean, and we need to understand that they constitute a very important part of our society. It's not an afterthought. Not at all.
Now, you're at Tuck Business School. You are talking to corporate leaders all the time, right? You're a consultant. You're training women to be leaders.
Oh, yes.
But you're also training corporate heads to look for leaders and to help grow leaders, nurture leaders.
Very much so.
So you're traveling between these different worlds. I mean, when everyone wants to hear the business case for women's leadership, so how do you make that?
You make that by the fact that within the next 5 years, you're going to have more women in the workforce than men, number one. You make the case that if you really want to have effective, a competitive business, then you need to develop your women. You make that case about development. It's about leadership. Leadership is vision. Leadership is making a difference. Leadership is being able to see ahead. But it is also, most importantly, about developing your people. If you don't have your people developed, if you don't have people that are excited about what they do, then you're going to get just an okie-dokie type of product, an okie-dokie client relationship, an okie-dokie brand, if you will. You can't afford to have that in this day and age. So part of what we do at Tuck is to recognize that leadership is at all levels, number one. Number two, it's not about male or female. If you talk to young males, I teach a lot of young males, young white males. And by young, they're in their 20s and their 30s. But what's very interesting, they don't want the same workplaces that their fathers had. You know, we keep talking about this as just a gender, a female issue. It is not just a female issue. They want to spend time with their families. They need time. They want time to reflect and to think about the kind of leaders they want to be, the kind of leaders that they are. They need time also to be able to be innovative, to be creative, to be able to come out with new ideas and new products that we haven't seen before that will carry us forward. They understand that they need all of this. So when we're talking about a workplace that believes in developing people, that believes in allowing people to be their best innovative creative size, that's just not a gender issue. That wants to be more collaborative. That's not just a gender issue. That wants to spend time with their children. That's not just a gender issue. It's a societal issue.
And that leads us to another point of interest that I know you and I really deeply share, which is changing the culture of work, right?
Oh, yes.
This isn't just about women, and it's not just about women's leadership programs, professional development. In fact, we've seen that all these very well-meaning HR programs aimed at women just haven't worked all that well, that the women end up getting siloed often enough when you talk about what's holding women back in
right.
this sort of gender-specific
right.
way, right, without right. really calling into question how the culture of work is negative for them, but it's really negative for everybody.
It's negative for everybody. You know, you talk about we still do programs that fix women.
Mm-hmm.
Even with Ascent, there's a map. There's a way that you can develop a woman to learn how to navigate success. We can do that. We do that in Ascent all the time, and we have a great track record with developing our women. And these are high-profile women that companies nominate.
Tell me the numbers again.
We have had about 70 women go through the program, not counting our current class of 29 women. We're a small boutique program for leadership development in partnership with the Tuck School of Business. And companies nominate. And we have Fortune 500, Fortune 100 companies. We deal with blue-chip companies. And out of the numbers, we have about 49 women who have advanced. Some have had to leave their companies. We don't push that. But we have had 49 women, and they do that by really creating supportive bonds with themselves. They are allies. So they support each other. They give each other the feedback they need to hear. They encourage the women to take the deep step, if you will, and go into the territory that they might not have thought about, which is really important for women to support each other. But going back to your cultural question, the cultures that we now see in most workplaces are highly individualistic, highly competitive. It's about me. It's about myself. It's about I. And it's also, here's the norms. We think about work. There's an old sociological study done, I think it was in the 60s or the 50s, and that's a lot of space, so forgive me. I should know. But the study was called The Organizational Man. And it talked about what the workforce needed. And it was about FaceTime. It was about, you know, being there. It was about showing your loyalty. It was showing how you were the best amongst the ranks. It was always rising to the occasion, which we still need. But it was how you rose to the occasion. It wasn't as collaborative. It wasn't about, you know, teamwork. It was about proving that you were the best, the youngest, and the brightest, and you were willing to do it all and show how hard you could work and just demonstrate this on an every day. You take that model today and people are burned out. You add technology to that model and it's deadly because work never turns off as
right.
a result.
Right. I mean, at the time when that book came out.
Do you remember the year, by the way?
I think it's the late 1950s.
Yeah, I right. think so, too. That's what I think.
But you had a mostly male, at least executive workforce.
Exactly.
But even with that, you had these men, these dads very often, who left the office at 5, right? They came home. They then had whatever time with their families they actually devoted to their families, but they were not working 24 hours a day. And, of course, they weren't on email. They didn't have cell phones. It was a completely
exactly.
different thing. The length of our work day has extended so greatly since that time. We're now one of the countries with the longest workday in the world. So what's happened? I mean, if it would be a different landscape for women, wouldn't it, if the work week had stayed something more like it was at the time?
It would be a different landscape, perhaps, because what enabled those men to go to work 9 to 5 every day were their wives that stayed home and were good corporate wives.
That's true.
You know, I mean, let's not forget the role. Now, that was a that was in our working class, that was in our poor, that was in our immigrant, that was in our people of color, because we know that men and women, if you were African American, were working. That was the only way you could, you know, keep a roof over your heads, quite honestly. But the reality of it is that model of femininity was really not enabling women who had education to be able to enter the workforce. And if you think back to the roots of Catalyst, Felice Schwartz's notion of what Catalyst was about was, how do you get educated women who were also corporate wives, who were also wives of these executives, if you will, who went to college, how do we get their voice on the table? Because they can make a contribution to our society, if you go back to the original mission of Catalyst. Now, that has changed over the decades. We all know that. But the reality of it is, when we're thinking, we've always played into the traditional masculine, hyper-masculine culture in the workplace. And we need to understand how detrimental that is to both men and women. The question is, how do you dismantle that? And the broader question, there are two broader questions. What's the nature of work? Can we redefine the nature of work? Number one. Number two, once we, you know, kind of define, what's competence look like? Because we define competence in the organizational male model, which is always going to work against women to some degree. And it's going to work to a lesser degree against men, particularly when you add technology and everything in. And we need policy. We need policy to help us reshape the workforce of tomorrow.
Do we have any models for this? Do we have models for policy in the U.S. or abroad? Do we have models for, since we have no policy in the U.S. along these lines, do we have models of corporations that are moving in the right direction? Do we know what this looks like, this work redefinition?
I don't know if we totally know what this looks like. I think some companies are beginning to grapple with this, and I think about it, and I don't want to name companies because I don't know if that would be the coolest thing to do. I do think we have some models of companies in our country. But I would certainly like to know what countries like Switzerland are doing, what countries like Sweden are doing, who seem to get this a little bit better than we do. I'd like to understand how they're reinventing work.
I think it's fine to name companies because I think it's important to understand that there are American examples, that this is not a foreign concept that's kind of pie in the sky, it'll never work.
Well, if you look at a company like Deloitte has a very good brand around doing this kind of work, quite honestly, about keeping women at the forefront, bringing women who decide to leave to have families to bring them back in.
By redefining work, redefining a valued employee?
Redefining a valued employee. And we've put money and energy into this. You have smaller companies like General Mills. That is doing this as well. Not that they're a small company, but they're in Minneapolis. I think they're based in Minneapolis. And what happens with them, a lot of our students want to go there because they feel they will have a greater sense of work-life balance as well as opportunity. That becomes very, very important. So those are some of the companies that come to mind when we start thinking about this. I think it's harder, though, for the financial institutions to do this.
Because of their culture,
because of the demands of that work. I think it's harder for consulting companies to do this because of the demands of the work. But we need to have those companies take the risk. All we need is one that's willing to take the risk and see how we can do this. But you've got to have the policy to support it. You've got to have the monies to support this. And I think, you know, we could answer that question better if there were monies made available to academics to actually go out and research. This is an area where we need research. We need futuristic thinking as well as the research on where we are now. And that requires resources, policy and resources. And I think we're lacking on both.
I want to just step back historically for a moment. We were talking about the late 1950s before, which is a period I think we're all kind of fascinated with often, you know, even culturally.
Mad Men.
Exactly. But just looking back in your own work, when you wrote Our Separate Ways, it was now, 14 years ago? I guess a little longer that you were working on it, right?
It took us 10 years.
Okay, so you span really a 20-year period.
A long time.
And you were, at that point, contrasting the career paths of African-American women and white women, yes. right? And what they were up against culturally. Right. So what have you seen change or not change since you started doing that work 20 years ago?
You know, it's funny. I remember our editor at Harvard Business Press said, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how your book is going to be received by younger women, because it took us a long time to do the research for a whole host of reasons. We did a in-depth life history analysis, and we had a huge sample, so it took us a little while. And the other person working with me, of course, is Stella Nkomo, my co-author. But what was really interesting when this book came out, and our book came out the summer before 9/11. So we all know what happened in our country when 9/11 came out. I'm surprised that anybody even knew this book came out. But what was absolutely amazing was the younger women that started to reach out, not just African-American women, but Hispanic women, Middle Eastern women. I had a young Middle Eastern woman in tears. I was at a conference. She cornered me and she said, "I read your book. I want you to know what we're going through as Middle Eastern women in this country, and the stereotypes that we're experiencing, and nobody's addressing, nobody's talking." There's a woman today in the audience who was a Middle Eastern who came up and hugged me, because it's just like it's not invisible. It's an invisible thing. So when you start talking to the younger women, not only the younger white women who are beginning to say, "Well, wait a minute, something's wrong with my career progress here," but when you started talking about the Latino women, the Asian women, all of a sudden it was not just black, white women, even though they had very different life journeys and trajectories in their careers. What was amazing was that everybody was talking about, "I'm not where I think I should be, and I'm working like crazy. I'm not being sponsored. I don't have mentors. I'm not sure what path. I'm hitting, you know, all kinds of obstacles, and I don't know how to get around them." And it was a chorus of women. It wasn't just black and white, because when we started this work, there were so few Hispanics, so few Asian women that we could draw on. The black women, the African-American women were there. So it's just very interesting now that there's a chorus of women. And the fascinating thing is that white women need to be included in this as well.
Yes, you've said, because white women have a culture too.
They have a culture too, number one.
And so they have to be viewed as multicultural multicultural.
I believe we all have a culture. You know, if you're Italian, if you're Jewish, you know, if you're Greek, you've got a culture. Think about what you eat at Christmas time. You know, think about how you celebrate your religion. It's culture. It's that simple. It's not racism. It's culture. But what's very interesting is that white women often get the opportunity to get to the leadership table first. And what we're trying to help them with and to give them the language for is to, once they get to the table, to turn around and say to the men at that table, the white men at that table, and sometimes African-American and Asian and Hispanic men at that table, "Where are my sisters? Where are the women who don't look like me? Why aren't they represented here?" Because the one at the table has to have the courage to ask the question. And that's really important.
Maya Harris, who was our moderator at the event today, a new senior fellow at CAP, said something to me in preparation for the event that I thought was very true. She said, you know, you have got two potential audiences, two groups that will be in the audience for this. You're going to have the group who are going to be enlightened and educated, basically the white women. She didn't say that, but, you know. And then there is the group who are going to be there and who are going to think, okay, I've heard this before. We've been talking about this for a really long time. You know, what do we do now? You said earlier, roll up our sleeves. So, you know, as we wrap up now, what's the takeaway for those two audiences, right, who are coming to this different history, different set of ears, different set of eyes, right, who are seeing things differently and who maybe have two take it forward slightly differently so that we all pull together and actually make change?
Well, you know, I see it a little bit differently. In your first group of your educated white women, they were educated black women who were more corporate. Remember, we had a woman from Booz Allen who was there. Your corporate, your private sector. What I'm also aware of, there was a huge not-for-profit sector. People who were working in the trenches and in women's organizations. This is Washington, D.C. So you had some of your foremothers who have been heading up these wonderful women's organizations. The roll up for me is how are we able to cross bridges and have more time? What CAP can do, we need a place, not just to sit down and talk about with the story, but we need a place to brainstorm, to think, okay, here's how I can work with you. Here's the resources I have, but here's the resources that you have. We don't have enough places to have those kinds of conversations. They're missing. And we desperately, desperately need them, because while we might have resources on our side and we might have a different voice, we might have access to PR, we might have access to research, we might have to scholarship or to thought leaders, many of those working groups don't. So we've got to figure out a way to put these groups together more so that we can actually build coalitions. We need, it's an old word, but it is so much needed right now. It really, really is, particularly in the gender voice. If not, my fear is that we will continue to be segmentized. We will continue to think about only the elite educated women and what their situations are as individual stories, and the individual, well, I made it, so you should be able to make it, or one or two make it, instead of recognizing that we have a whole group behind us. And how do we build those bridges in a collaborative, cooperative way becomes a critical question.
That's a great takeaway, and it's a great, clear way to stop, because we have our next steps right there, which is to brainstorm about how to bring that coalition about using the resources that we have.
And put policymakers in that. That was the other group that was in the room. We need to have access to policymakers. That is critical. Nobody better to do that than your organization, CAP.
You're absolutely right, Ella. Ella Edmondson-Bell, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having
me.
I'm
appreciate
honored.
It.
I am absolutely delighted. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.